Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon and welcome along to Unbelievable. This is the programme that brings different perspectives together for dialogue and debate, creating conversations that matter every Saturday here as part of Faith Explored on Premier Christian Radio and available around the world as a podcast via our website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Links there, of course, to other Unbelievable resources, including this year's Unbelievable conference on DVD and CD and, of course, the digital download. Perfect for the apologetics lover in your life if you want to get hold of it for them for Christmas. Equally, they might be interested in Unbelievable, the book, the story of this show, and why, after 10 years of talking with atheists, I'm still a Christian. My very first book, very pleased that it's out there and being discussed and debated and looked at, and you can get the audio version, a signed copy of the book, and much more from our website, unbelievablebook.co.uk. I was able to be on Janet Parshall's show again. That's a show that airs out in the USA on the Moody Radio Network, In the Market with Janet Parshall. So that's available to listen back to again, and hoping to join her again in the not too distant future on her US radio show. But it's great to have these opportunities to tell people further afield about the Unbelievable show. And we'll be hearing your thoughts about some of the recent editions of the programme towards the end of today's show. Lots of your feedback that I've been saving up. So look out for that towards the end of today's programme. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme, we're asking questions such as, is it okay to believe in God on the basis of its practical psychological value? Mike McCarg, a.k.a. Science Mike, is the author of God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. Now, he came on Unbelievable last year to tell his story, and he returns this week to offer his perspective on whether there's a rational basis for God belief, and his view that God and science are primarily reconciled by seeing the pragmatic value of prayer, religious experience, and things like going to church. Well, in conversation with Mike this week, J.D. Walters is with me. He's a Christian maths and science teacher. He's a writer fascinated by the big questions of God and faith. A regular listener to Unbelievable, he read Mike's book last year, really appreciated it, and wanted to engage with him on these issues. And when I heard Mike was coming back to the UK for a little tour, I thought, well, why don't we get JD and Mike together? And JD's particularly concerned, though, about whether Mike might have thrown out the rational basis for belief in God too readily. So we're going to be talking about these sorts of ideas. Can we support the existence of God through rational argument? Is it okay to believe in God on the basis of its practical psychological value, and so on? Before we come to JD, Mike, welcome back to the studio. Great to have you back in the UK.
It's great to be here in person this time.
Absolutely. It was a sort of Skype thing we did last time. This time it's JD on the Skype, but it's great to have you here in studio and meet you face to face. I was actually reading your book while I was writing a book last year. And when I read your book while I was writing mine, it really depressed me because I thought, I'm never going to be able to write a book as good as this, because I really enjoyed your book. And the writing alone, really sold it for me, whether or not you agree with some of the ideas in it. I really love the writing. So I'm a fanboy, but tell me about, just for those who maybe this is the first time encountering your story, I know you've told it a million times, would you just sum it up in a quick version of what happened to you, Mike?
I grew up in the conservative evangelical tradition in the United States, which means I had a highly rational, highly personal view of the Creator and a personal understanding of salvation through Jesus Christ. That worked really well for me. It led to a sense of belonging and community that I appreciated, and a profound sense of purpose, because I lived to serve a God that I loved. I had a moral crisis in my life. My father had an affair. He was a music minister in our church, and that led me to search for what God's understanding and desire for marriage was. And to do that, I read the Bible 4 times in 1 year. And at the end of that process, I was an atheist. I probably would still be an atheist, but I had a strange encounter with God where I heard God speak to me, which just sounds nuts. It is nuts. I get it. And then I saw God as a really bright light before me, like visually, not like sort of in my head. And I was so moved by the experience, I asked my neurologist for a CAT scan because I thought I had brain cancer. And when there was no tumor, I was left trying to figure out what was that. And that led me to pick my Bible back up to encounter the same problems I saw when I put it down. And so instead I turned toward cosmology and quantum dynamics and ultimately neuroscience to understand how humans long for God, how they experience God, and ultimately to find my way back to a relationship with a God that I had trouble believing in.
Obviously, though, the faith you went back to was quite different to the faith you had left, in a sense, that the type of belief in God that you had. And in that sense, you no longer advocate a sort of, in a sense, rationalistic view of belief in God. It's much more an experientialist thing. Because reading your book, it's interesting because, you know, at some points you say some things and at some points you say other things. And sometimes the reader is left wondering, OK, where exactly does Mike stand on these issues? Because we all want everyone to sort of state exactly what they believe on all things, don't we? But the question is, I suppose you sometimes talk about yourself still remaining an intellectual atheist while at the same time believing in God. So a lot of people will be, well, how can those two things go together?
Well, the reason they say that is because they're proper modernists, and they live in a post-Enlightenment framework where we understand reality primarily as a set of logical propositions that we agree with or don't agree with, and the measure of a good worldview is the degree to which our propositions line up. And that kind of thinking is really useful. You can't build a recording studio with intuition. You need a really consistent physical understanding of reality, iPhones, antibiotics, robots on Mars, all these things come from a rational worldview. But when we talk about faith, rational inquiry tells us it's not a rational process. We can say it should be all day long, but you could also say that the way humans relate to food should be rational. But it's fundamentally not. The brain science reveals that when we approach God, our brains move into an experiential state.
Okay. And so do you think, by and large, the apologetic endeavor is somewhat misguided as far as its focus on a kind of rational case for the existence of God?
Absolutely not. So when we understand a bias in the human brain, some of us more readily process experiences in intuitive ways, some more in rational ways. And neuroscientists have found people who are especially prone to rational thinking can't have an experiential view of God without first having a rational view of God. The problem with apologetics comes when we prescribe exclusively rational means of processing God to people for whom that is not their natural temperament.
Really interesting. I'm so glad we can get you back in the studio in person, Mike.
You're going to find I typically am like, all views are great for someone.
Well, look, it's great to have on the line as well, joining us for this conversation, J.D. Walters, who's a regular show listener and read Mike's book, really appreciated it, and wanted to engage with him on some of the issues. J.D., do you want to just give us a little background on you and how you've come into really, you know, engaging in the whole science and faith debate?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually had a kind of unusual background. So I was actually born into a cultish group that was an offshoot of the Jesus people that you've actually, I think, mentioned on Premier Christianity recently, the Jesus movement that came out of Huntington Beach. So in that group, we were taught that the end of the world was imminent and that we needed to isolate ourselves from the evil system. So while I was in the group, it was very insular. So I didn't really have access to a lot of things to read outside of the group materials, but I was extremely curious. I was reading by the age of 2, So I read whatever I could get my hands on. And at the time, it was just the group literature. So that was my default worldview. So I was kind of indoctrinated to an extent. But once my family pulled away from the group, I started to read more. And especially in high school, I was exposed to popular science books by writers like Brian Greene and Michio Kaku. And I, needless to say, I was incredibly fascinated. And it did start to break down my very insular view of faith and the world. And that led to a full-blown crisis of faith when I got to college, largely as a result of the usual suspects. So biblical criticism, which undermined the inspiration of the Bible, the problem of evolution, which tied into that, the problem of other religions. So all these things brought my narrow fundamentalist worldview crashing down. And for an extended period, I was quite depressed because it felt like life had no foundation anymore. I didn't have a solid anchor. But gradually, and to my surprise, I found my faith getting built back up. And this was largely due to exposure to real theology, as opposed to the delusional rantings of the group leader. And in particular, when I first read Contra Celsum, which was an early book by the early church writer Origen, I sort of had an aha moment as I realized that the questions that I was wrestling with surrounding faith and Christianity have been around since the beginning. Mm-hmm. And so I was kind of able to breathe a sigh of relief and to realize, okay, I'm not alone in this. There have been people throughout history who've been wrestling with these questions. And the more I read from the mainstream Christian tradition, particularly the works of Aquinas and other classical theologians, I found my way to an understanding of faith that was both intellectually rigorous, able to accommodate all the results of biblical criticism and modern science, but also still spiritually satisfying. Mm. So today, I kind of continue in that. That's basically where I am today. So I do teach science and math because that was kind of my first love. And even though I kind of switched my focus to exploring the big questions, I still really enjoy math and science. I believe in them as ways of making sense of the physical world. But at the same time, I continue to read and study and have conversations with people who are also exploring these questions. And I guess my views continue to be refined. Certainly, they're not static at this point. There are still things I'm unsure about. But I've arrived at a point where I feel like the classical theistic understanding of God is just an incredibly satisfying way of conceiving of what is ultimately real and supremely valuable.
Such a helpful introduction to you, JD, and in a sense, matching Mike's story at various points along the way as well. Mike, I mean, mm-hmm. do you meet lots of people like JD who, rather like you, have had some major crisis of faith because of a certain way of understanding scripture and upbringing? I'm yep. guessing you do.
It's more strange if I meet someone who has not.
Right. You are the faith crisis guy.
Yes.
When it comes to meeting people on this road. But, I mean, having said that, I think what we'll find in the course of today's program is that you still come out in slightly different ways of that process in terms of where you land on the relationship between science and faith and so on, and obviously the case for the rational sort of case for God in a sense as well. So we're going to be exploring that as we open up the questions today.
Great.
On the program. If you're listening and you'd like to get in touch about today's show, you're very welcome to send in an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Try and read as many of those out at the end of every show as I can. And again, if you want to get in touch via social media, @unbelievablejb is our Twitter, facebook.com/unbelievablejb to follow us on Facebook. All of those details and, of course, today's show, a way to subscribe to the podcast and more besides available from the website, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we're asking today, is it okay to believe in God on the basis of its practical psychological value? Now, Well, we'll let Mike explain for himself, but that's certainly one of the takeaways that appears to be in Mike's book, which has been a bestseller, God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. Mike was on this show last year to talk about that with an atheist. This time he returns to talk with another Christian who's had a not dissimilar journey, but come out in a slightly different way from it. J.D. Walters is our other guest on the programme today. But perhaps maybe what it would be good is to kind of just ask you a few more questions and let JD come in on this about where you land, Mike, on this subject of the rational argument for God. I mean, obviously, JD was saying he did in the end feel satisfied that he had come to an understanding of reality that was best undergirded by the reality of a classical God, you know, in Christian worldview, as it were. And that's the view I receive from many people who've maybe gone through a similar journey to you or JD and said, actually, certainly my faith is not the same one as the fundamentalist one I grew up with. But nevertheless, an ultimate cause certainly makes a lot of sense of the data that we see around us. It's a reasonable thing to believe rationally in that God, and maybe not dismissing the absolutely experiential element of that as well. But do you quibble with that, you know, or is it just okay, that works for you, not for me, kind of thing?
I mean, I'm a born peacemaker, so I quibble with very little. When I quibble, tends to be impact on human life. That's usually my non-negotiables. And I think in terms of, you know, a theistic framework for God, that's a way of understanding reality that works for hundreds of millions, billions of people on Earth today. So it's a very common way of relating to the Almighty. You know, I think, I don't know how much to nitpick, but, you know, if we talk about a cause, we're talking about cause as justification for God is more of a deistic view than a theistic view. But that's, you know, that's style points. Who cares? I would say that in my work, what I'm finding is for many, many millions and indeed an increasing number of people, a classical theistic notion of God creates more problems than it solves and leads people to be less and not more able to encounter and be transformed by the life and teachings of Jesus Christ. And if you look at, Origen's phenomenal, but there are other streams in early Christianity based around a more experiential or mystical understanding of God or the divine. And I think these are not fundamentally incompatible. I think the problem comes, as so often does, when we use our faith experiences or our rational analysis of faith experiences to prescribe a single perspective on God as the correct one. And this produces a giant gumbo of contradictory theological claims that ultimately play themselves out in societal tension all the way to physical violence.
JD, just be interested, firstly, on what you got out of Mike's book, you know, on the positive side, the things you really appreciated about reading his journey and the way he came back to faith. And maybe just start to lay out where you have one or two issues with Mike's sort of rejection at some level of a kind of rationalistic sort of classical theist view of God in preference for something more experiential.
So I do want to second that it's incredibly well written. It just was really enjoyable to read. I really appreciated with and resonated with Mike's honesty. I feel like he lays out his experience and his journey in a very clear, easy to digest way. I do share his appreciation for science. I was really like that ever since high school. I would complain in physics class that we were still on Newton's laws and weren't talking about black holes and superstring theory yet.
Basically, you were as much of a science geek as Mike was at school. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. And I did also find his proposed axioms really fascinating as a way to sort of find a least common denominator that would allow people who are skeptical and who doubt the existence of God to sort of find their way to a practice of faith that wouldn't, as Mike puts it, make them feel foolish. So I did really appreciate it. I think it's a substantive work, and I actually think that it does contain a coherent proposal for how to understand faith in the modern context. So those things I really did appreciate about it.
So what then about the kind of the concerns then, in terms of obviously lots of appreciation there for the book? What was the aspects of where Mike obviously didn't feel that the argument for God really stood up in intellectual terms? Did you feel that he threw the baby out with the bathwater a bit at some level in the book?
Well, for one thing, I didn't really recognize the rational case for God as I had encountered it in the mainstream tradition. In Mike's summaries that he gives for how his faith in God fell apart. So basically, he mentions the God delusion and the works of other skeptics as having sort of broken down the God hypothesis. So he says that each new book that he read from the skeptics introduced him to new arguments that challenge God's existence. He says that prominent scientists make easy work of theologians, and that the God hypothesis is sort of it's a mix of logical failures. And I just did not recognize that from my own reading. I've read many of the same skeptic books, and I found myself scratching my head as to how anyone could be persuaded by their arguments, because in fact what even most professionals, including professional atheists, would say about those books is that they're actually quite poor. And far from prominent scientists making easy work of theologians, it most often turns out that theologians catch prominent scientists with their philosophical pants down. And they often completely misunderstand theological arguments. They don't engage with theological arguments in their strongest terms. And in fact, this problem is so severe that atheists even have a description for it. They call it the emperor's new clothes approach. So they claim that, oh, theologians keep saying you never engage the most sophisticated arguments, but when you look at the most sophisticated arguments, there's really nothing to see there either. But I find that that's just an excuse they give for not really engaging with the works of someone like Aquinas, for example. So one concern I had was that his critique of the God hypothesis, at least as it's outlined in the book, it doesn't really hold water for me. I didn't think that the objections, for example, okay, the milk jug or the prayer studies, I didn't find that they really constituted good reasons for rejecting the God hypothesis in the first place.
Well, let me come to Mike just to ask what kind of were the main things you outlined in the book that sort of caused you to reject a sort of rationalistic kind of argument type for God in the book? What were some of the key arguments? I mean, JD mentioned the milk jug and so on. I don't know if you want to expound on those ones in particular.
Sure. The milk jug was big for me. For many people, prayer is the primary means by which they relate to God and understand God experientially, and that was true for me. So while I had a systematic theology that described a theistic God, one of the pillars I used to justify that was God presenting evidence for himself through responding to prayer.
Mm-hmm.
So for me and for many Christians who lack JD's sophistication, attacking prayer by saying praying to a milk jug has the same results as praying to God. And by the way, I prayed to a milk jug for a promotion for several weeks and got the promotion. So now, like, this, am I a milkist now? Is God's power only as long as the milk is not expired? I mean, it puts you in a really bizarre headspace. But in general, the thing that leads me to say something like, atheists make easy work of theologians is the impact of skeptical work.
Okay.
Skeptics aren't increasing in number the way you would think they would be, but what they are successfully doing is make an argument for people that they should leave religion behind. And that's happening on a huge scale in the United States and across the world.
I mean, I guess JD's concern here is, though, that the milk jug, you know, example, while powerful at some rhetorical level for many people, is not, if you like, a really it's something of a facile argument as far as he's concerned against the existence of God. But I guess what you're not presenting that as the strongest argument against God.
No,
just it's one of the most popular and easy to access type of argument.
Yeah, I would say a stronger one would be if you're using rationalism to get to theism, how do you decide which theism is the correct theism? On what sort of measurement, what sort of justification do you use to, you know, put an Aquinas-centered Judeo-Christian God over Luther's God, or the conception of theism in the Catholic Church, or the conception of theism in Islam, or any other theistic faith? Theism and rational inquiry into God produces so many counterclaims. How do I, as a neutral observer, or even an observer deeply interested in knowing and following God, decide which set of rational frameworks is the correct one?
Quick response from you, JD, and then we'll go to a break.
So what I actually found in my own search is that problem is rather easy to deal with. It turns out that when you really look into even very different religious traditions, when it comes to the question of what is ultimate reality like, it seems that they all come to agree on a few basic ideas. For example, that ultimate reality has to exist on its own somehow, that it can't be dependent on anything else for its existence. And as such, there can only be one of those, because if you have two things that don't depend on anything else, I mean, how can they be different? In order for them to be different, they would have to have some sort of relationship to each other. So, and there are various other arguments that are found across religious traditions that seem to very interestingly hone in on an understanding of God as transcendent, unique, all-powerful. And there are even further arguments, for example, presented by Ed Fazer in his new book, Five Proofs for the Existence of God, that allow us to conclude that he's also all-knowing and has will and so on. So I found in my own reading that there's a powerful case for, if nothing else, at least an understanding of God that is in line with the great monotheistic traditions.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back again. We're talking about science and faith today. Science Mike, also known as Mike McCarg, author of God in the Waves, is with me again this week. JD Walters is a Christian math and science teacher fascinated by the big questions of God and faith, interacting with Mike on the question of whether we can support the existence of God through rational arguments, something Mike says he found was ultimately unhelpful to him, wasn't the way he was going to connect with God if he was going to, in his book. And we're going to go on to talk about whether it's okay to believe in God essentially on the basis of its practical psychological value as well in the next part of today's show. Hope you can stay here on Unbelievable, where we aim to get interesting conversations going every week. Be back in a moment's time.
Whatever happened to the promised revival? In the latest Premier Christianity magazine, New Frontiers leader Terry Virgo asks whether it's time to reignite revival hopes as he looks at moves of God, past, present, and future. Plus, from Justin Welby to the HDB effect, we examine how evangelicals took over the Church of England. Find out why adoption turned Krish Kandaya's life and theology upside down, and meet Christina Dean, pioneering fashion designer who scours rubbish tips to create ethical clothing. All that plus much more. Ask for your free sample copy at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to this week's edition of the show. Is it okay to believe in God on the basis of its practical psychological value? We're asking today. Mike McCarg and JD Walters with me in studio. This is Unbelievable, the show that aims to get different perspectives talking every week. And if you want to find out more about the show, some of the resources available, my own book, which I mentioned earlier on. No competitors to Mike's, I assure you, but it's available there from the show webpage as well as various other resources, videos, articles and so on. PremierChristianRadio.com/unbelievable. Unbelievable. Straight after today's show, The Profile is here as usual, also available on its own podcast, where we catch up with a Christian with some walk of faith and life to tell us about. That's between 4 and 5 on Premier Christian Radio. Right now, we're talking about these issues that we've been talking about on the basis of Mike's book, which I've wrongly been calling up till now God in the Waves. It's Finding God in the Waves.
Gotta have that verb. You know,
absolutely, yeah. Kind of makes a bit more sense. Finding God in the Waves, How I Lost My Faith and Found It Again Through Science. So Mike came on to talk about that book last year on the programme with an atheist, returns to talk to another Christian about it this time, but someone who went through a not dissimilar crisis of faith to Mike's, but came out more convinced of the rational basis for believing in God than Mike is, and also with some questions around Mike's sort of mission to reconcile God and the sciences by putting them together in the way that religious experience is a helpful psychological thing as much as anything. And that's perhaps a good place to go to next, because in a sense, Mike, if I could come back to you and picking up that issue of prayer again, mm-hmm. you always had a problem with rationally justifying how a God could answer prayer, or how you could possibly tell if God was answering prayer or not, given that you see the same results from praying to a milk jug and so on. Nonetheless, you still see value in prayer. I mean, and that's primarily because of the psychological well-being type of value that science tells us comes about through prayer. I mean, do you want to detail some of those aspects of prayer?
Absolutely. If you look at prayer not as a spiritual discipline, but as a neurological one, some of the claims that skeptics make about faith are rebutted by their own science. When people pray regularly, they experience changes in the way their brain functions. They experience more activity in their prefrontal cortex and their anterior cingulate cortex. Those are the parts of the brain responsible for focus and concentration and compassion and empathy, respectively. And doing that makes the amygdala less likely to engage in any stimulus, which is responsible for fear and anger. So praying people are what? More attentive, more compassionate, less driven by fear or anger. And this leads them to have lower levels of stress, literally lower blood pressure. Prayer is so powerful in working on concentration. It's been shown to have a therapeutic effect for dementia and Alzheimer's patients. It has a therapeutic effect, similarly psychologically, to seeing a therapist. So prayer transforms us into more patient, more loving, more gracious people.
I saw a tweet just this morning from an atheist, though, and I think it was in response to, you know, one of the latest Pray For sort of hashtags in regard to, you know, something. And he said, for me, praying is worse than doing nothing, because not only are you doing nothing, but you probably think you're doing something helpful when you're not, and convincing yourself, therefore, that you have done something, so effectively deluding yourself. I mean, what would be your response to that sort of typical kind of atheist view of prayer?
What a wonderful critique that I need to internalize. Because if my praying for something discourages me from acting personally, then my personal therapeutic effect is unwarranted and unhelpful. At its best, prayer not only lets us attain a sense of peace, lets us attain a sense of awareness of connection with God, but also to envision the way in which we may be a part of the solution. So if I'm praying for disaster relief in Puerto Rico, for the suffering there, by thinking of people every day in prayer, I should also be propelled to personally invest myself in rendering aid. Prayer, when attached to meaningful action, is powerful. Prayer alone, I agree, thoughts and prayers don't help the hungry at all.
And I guess James put it, you know, well, faith without works is dead, in a mm-hmm. sense. But JD, where do you come in on this? I mean, be interested how you would respond to that atheist tweet and what you make of the science that Mike's bringing here in terms of the beneficial psychological aspect of praying, and whether you think this is pertinent to the question of whether we should pray and whether prayer works and so on.
Well, I've read a lot of the same studies that he's been talking about. And I happily agree that prayer does in fact have those beneficial psychological and social effects. I think that's just one of the amazing benefits of the gift that is prayer. But I definitely believe in a God who's constantly at work in the world, most of the time through what we call ordinary action. So that action is simply sustaining the world and its processes in being, and they pretty much unfold the same way pretty much every time, kind of like how in a musical symphony you may have sections where the same notes, the same set of notes repeats over and over. But I do also think that at times and at places, God does change his mode of action and allows for something to happen that we wouldn't otherwise expect. So that's a long-winded way of saying that I do believe in intercessory prayer. I would agree with Mike that it's probably not a good idea to look for evidence of God in terms of answered prayer. So if we kind of approach it as a test, so I'm going to pray, and if my prayer is answered, that's evidence that God exists. That's not a very helpful strategy, because I take it that the point of the milk jug is that lots of things are happening all the time, and it could be that it just so happens that when we happen to be hoping, wishing, praying for something, and that thing actually happens, that could well just be coincidence. However, in a framework in which it's already accepted that God exists and is at work in the world, we may not be able to take individual cases as providing an argument or evidence that God exists, but it may serve to justify or fortify that framework, and we might be rationally justified in interpreting certain events as answered prayer. Now, in response to that particular atheist tweet, I certainly reject that. I don't think prayer is doing nothing, but I want to go beyond what Mike said, because it's not just helpful in terms of connecting us with people and making us more disposed to consider their needs, making us more empathetic, although it certainly does have that effect. But I do think it is possible to pray confidently to God and hope for an outcome that goes beyond what nature itself could produce.
I mean, that's a helpful way of putting it. I mean, just briefly as well, JD, just to kind of what do you make of the idea, though, that Mike sees it primarily, the God thing, as about, though, that psychological benefit rather than there being a necessarily truth or an empirical kind of grounding to belief in God? It is primarily about the psychological benefit of believing in God.
Well, I think if prayer is just about the psychological benefits, I think it should be practiced as something more like meditation, instead of having it framed in terms of requests that are actually made to a God in order for God to work in the world. And that kind of leads to the heart of my problem with Mike's pragmatic approach. I start from Aristotle's dictum that all men by nature desire to know. And part of that desire to know is the desire to have a true understanding of what it is we're actually doing in different situations. So if we are not actually petitioning a God who is there and who does have the power to bring about new things in different situations, I don't think that prayer should be made within that framework. I think we can find some other framework. We can find some like quiet description where you tell yourself, I'm becoming more connected with people, I'm focusing on their needs. There are all sorts of frameworks for meditation, but I think it does a disservice to prayers if we continue to say, no, it's okay to pray, for example, in the Christian way or in the traditional Jewish way, when we have no idea whether the God at the center of those traditions actually exists and is capable of acting.
What do you say to that, Mike?
I think wondering if God exists and is capable of acting is one of the most traditionally Jewish and Christian things you can do. Mm-hmm. I think it's baked into the biblical narrative. I think the discussion between Job and his friends underlies the fact that the ancients, too, wondered, is anyone listening? And if they are listening, are they just? And by what means do I know if I am pleasing or displeasing God? These are ancient ideas. And when we take these ancient ideas and force them into a more modern framework, I think we do them a disservice. When I pray to God in an intercessory way, I am actually investing in a faith, a hope, a trust that in some way God is there and God is listening, but I'm also acknowledging that other people can with good reason think that's nutty. Mm-hmm. It's a way of my pragmatic approach to faith is how I have meaningful conversation with people who haven't tasted that which we call God. It's not to say that I abandon any pretext of a God that animates, as so beautifully said by J.D., in ordinary action. That's at the heart of how I understand God. I just admit that for as long as there have been people wrestling with faith, the efficacy of prayer and the presence of the Almighty have been in fundamental question. I even look at the life of Christ as recorded in the Gospels. A Christ who on the cross says, God, why have you forsaken me? If possible, could this cup be passed from me? Wandering in the desert, listening to temptation and wondering about his role in the world and his relationship to the Creator. This level of doubt is not an aberration or a departure from a historic faith. It's at the very center.
I mean, are you saying, though, that you can only pray if you don't doubt God? I mean, I'm guessing that's not quite what you're saying, JD.
Oh, no, absolutely not. I do think there is room in the tradition for doubting, even to the point of doubting God's existence, or if he does exist, whether he's just, or whether he cares about human concerns. After all, faith is a journey for all of us. I think one thing that is often insufficiently emphasized in these discussions is that faith is a journey over time. So there may be periods in life where we feel less confident about certain things. There may be other periods where we feel more confident. But when it comes to the traditions themselves, I would regard the questions about God's existence and providence as temporary. In other words, temporary states that some authors and some people within the tradition move through for a while, but that state is ultimately sort of hemmed in on either side by a fundamental stance of confidence. Mm. So I do think there are episodes when people do doubt, but it's always part of a movement where they doubt but then are drawn back for some reason. I don't think there's really room in the tradition for a constant, ongoing state of fundamental uncertainty.
I mean, I have a friend, JD, who struggles to believe in God, but she does say she prays because she wants to believe in God. Now, is that enough for you to kind of warrant praying? Just the kind of, there's a fundamental drive, a desire for there to be a God to pray to, almost.
Absolutely. Again, everyone has their own faith journey, and I was in a similar position for a while. No doubt your friend is currently in that position. And of course, someone like Pascal would say that if you find yourself, the way he puts it, having seen too much to deny when it comes to evidence for God's existence, but too little to be sure, the best thing you can do is put yourself in a sort of receptive position where you start to engage in those practices. I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Okay.
But I do think such a stance presupposes, at the very least, that you grant that God is a coherent concept, and there's at least some evidence that there may be such a being, as opposed to a state where the rational case for God is in complete shambles, and all we can do is sort of maintain a hope, as Mike puts it, that there might be such a being.
Is that quite where you're at, Mike, in terms of when you're praying, you've really got no confidence that there is a God there listening to your prayer?
I think to say something like a rational case for God is to be ahistoric about faith.
Okay.
Rationalism is a movement in human history that had a beginning not that long ago. And so to project rationalism onto the authors of Scripture is, in my opinion, to butcher history. So to have a relational confidence with God, as depicted in the Old Testament, I do have a relational confidence in God and indeed in the person and incarnation of Jesus Christ. But I understand that many people, modernists, functioning from a rational framework, would say that your relational connection bears no evidence or justification in my life. And because I'm not a person who tends to be a boundary drawer, if someone says, I want to pray, I don't believe in God, what can I do? I'm absolutely comfortable talking to them in scientific terms about what may help them achieve the ends they're looking for.
And that's done, as you say in the book, sort of through these axioms to some extent. It's about the kind of, as JD described it, the lowest common denominator, where we can agree that God is at least the such and such and such of the universe or whatever it might be.
Can I actually just add a very quick point? To this idea that rationalism about faith is a very recent historical phenomenon. I'm not sure where this is coming from, because if you go all the way back to people like, first of all, Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle, who are sort of the font of the classical theistic tradition, what you find even way back then is a fundamental concern for truth and whether things like the existence of God and the immortality of the soul can be established on rational grounds. And that fundamental drive to know and to know the truth about issues of ultimate concerns, I think you find that all throughout history. So we can move into the Hellenistic period with figures like Philo. We can move on from there into the Middle Ages, certainly people like Anselm and Aquinas, and certainly in the modern period. I just think it's people wanting to know, is there a God?
And I suppose it could be argued that even Paul in Athens is doing something along the lines of a rationalist kind
of
approach
New
to God.
All these New Testament Hellenized writers discuss rationalism because it's the birth of rationalism in human culture. My point is the ancient Bible, the Hebrew Scriptures, are not placed within a rational context because such a thing did not exist.
Let me move on, because I just want to ask before time runs out here. I get the impression, Mike, but you can correct me if I'm wrong here, that you don't necessarily believe in an interventionist God. And from that point of view, that would raise the question for a lot of people, well, what do you do with the biblical stories of miracles, not least the resurrection, obviously, which, you know, for many people is a central issue, central claim of the Christian faith, that God did act in history, did something miraculous, did something outside of the normal laws of nature, if you like, and so on. Where do you go with that kind of a thing when it comes to, you know, how God, science, and faith interact and whether we're justified in believing in a God who intervenes in the natural world?
I mean, that's the messy middle of my entire identity, is someone who has internalized and reflected upon and finds merit in a materialist, empiricist view of reality that leaves no room for the supernatural, and yet for whom the most essential understanding of reality is that the fabric of the cosmos is love, and that love was expressed by an empty tomb, a conquering of death by this love that animates everything. So the way I navigate that is to say, when I say something that to modern ears sounds absurd, like a guy walked out of an empty tomb, and that gives me the hope and the confidence to be a person who loves others without limit, is to leave the space for someone to say, hey, that sounds crazy, and for me to say, yeah, I understand why you would say that.
They thought it was crazy back then.
They thought it was crazy back then, and I often feel like it's crazy too. And yet, when I live in this story, it completely transforms me. And so I just allow myself to live in it
a classic case of cognitive dissonance, or is that just the way people often bring different aspects of reality that they sort of recognize
together? We're not primarily cognitive animals. Cognition and rationalism are a tool that we developed primarily to convince other people to agree with us in a social setting. And our fundamental orientation toward reality is actually much more intuitive and much more holistic. What I'm saying is I allow the more ancient parts of my brain to function in the way that they are designed to without suspending the neocortical, hyper-rational picture of reality. I just use both, and when they disagree with each other, I understand that's part of being
human,
a social primate.
Right.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting way of putting it. JD, what's your problem with that?
Well, first of all, I think that denying that we are, you know, essentially cognitive animals, I think is to sell us short to an extent. I grant that our behavior and our way of being in the world have multiple sources. But I do think that, again, as Aristotle put it so eloquently, all men by nature desire to know. Even if certain events in our lives, so traumatic events that we go through or social pressure and things like that, even if they sometimes cause us to think less than rationally, I do believe that with a consistent effort, we can orient ourselves around the pursuit of truth. And I think that science is testimony to the fact that the pursuit of truth is incredibly satisfying. But as far as the supernatural interventionist understanding of God, I think the fact that certain claims of intervention sound absurd to modern ears kind of stem from the parochial viewpoint of Western culture in general. Because again, if we widen the scope to include other times, but also other cultures, we find that human history is full of completely sane, wise people, including as much independent testimony, as much careful written testimony as you may desire, of events that even sound more incredible than someone walking out of a tomb. So you just have to look through the records from the Hindu tradition, from the Islamic tradition, certainly from the Jewish and Christian traditions. These are not crazy things that we're talking about. We're talking about things that people throughout history, and not just fundamentalists and loons, that people have been testifying to since the beginning of recorded history. And certainly when it comes to the interaction of God and science, I think the thing to keep in mind, and which in fact Mike himself expressed very eloquently in the book, is that science gives us a very abstract understanding of reality. So it kind of gives us it tells us basically about patterns of things that tend to happen as we've observed them. But from the fact that we have a certain consensus right at the moment of, you know, what things tend to do when in certain situations, that does not follow that those patterns are absolute. Again, the analogy I like to use is a musical symphony. You can have long stretches where the same notes repeat over and over. And if you were just looking at those sections, you might think, okay, that's all that's going to happen in this symphony. But then just when you least expect it, there's a new note, a new rhythm, and that may well cast the rest of the symphony in a completely new light.
Just a couple of minutes before we have to go to our final break and a quick wrapping up, Mike, to respond to that. I saw you nodding in agreement to a lot of what JD was saying there.
Yeah, I think it's clear JD and I agree on most of what we say. this idea that modernism and Western culture is parochial, yeah, I'm in, totally. That's one perspective.
And when it comes to, I mean, is there a question mark over whether you've brought too much wholesale what is also a modernist perspective in terms of the scientific kind of, you know, structure of reality that in it only conforms to a certain pattern. JD's saying, hey, new patterns can happen. You know, let's not always assume that we're living in a completely determined sort of universe in that sense.
Yeah, that's why I remain open to spiritual experiences. But I just say that when investigating the consensus of material reality we all experience, modernism brings a set of tools that are unmatched in answering physical questions. And that's sure. With the deepest respect for faith and faith experiences. And indeed, you know, Aristotle's desire to know. It's interesting that this founding mind in rationalism uses intuitive language to justify rationalism. All men desire to know. The knowing comes from a layer of tissue around our brain about as thick as a tortilla, and the desire comes from this intuitive brick of neurological tissue that sits underneath. And I just think it's important that when we talk about cognition, we understand the satisfaction we get from cognition is our neocortex appealing to the more ancient and more powerful limbic brain.
We're going to go to a very quick break, and we'll be back as we conclude our discussion here between Science Mike and J.D. Walters.
If you want to have a massive reason why human beings are special, here it is. God became one.
We can be part of God's plan to bring hope to a hopeless generation.
We're living in an exciting time to be a follower of Jesus. The golden age of Christianity, ladies and gentlemen.
We live in a universe that has a story that is ultimately about love.
There's a God-shaped hole in the heart of every person. It can only be filled by God, made known through Jesus Christ.
Hear the world's leading Christian thinkers make the case for Christ at Unbelievable, the Conference 2017. Now available not only on DVD, but also as a digital download. Order online at premier.org.uk/shop.
Welcome back to the final part of today's Unbelievable show. This is the radio show and podcast that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate each week. Available at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable as a podcast, and get lots of people all over the world sending in their thoughts and emails each week. Here's Joel in Australia, says, discovered your show a couple of months ago and has since been listening to the podcast quite eagerly. I'm a Catholic and scientist in Melbourne, Australia, working with neural implants for medical uses. I've been particularly enjoying the shows where you set up discussions on science and theology, probably because being a Christian scientist is certainly not mainstream and can sometimes feel a bit lonely. It's great to be reminded that Christianity and intellectual endeavour are compatible. Educated inner city culture in Australia is becoming increasingly anti-religious, and Christianity given a bad reputation by public figures who are bigoted anti-science, pro-fossil fuel advocates. I see no reason for some viewpoints to be associated with Christian ideas, and I like that your show approaches all topics with an open attitude and passion for philosophical discussion. I think you're doing great work in the name of Christ. Hope many more listeners discover your show throughout the Anglosphere and maybe the whole world. Bless you and good luck. Thank you, Joel. And Daniel Buck says, I'm from Budapest, Hungary. I have a few friends that really enjoy apologetics. Do you know if there's a large number of people who listen to the show in Budapest? I'd like to start a group for people to come and talk about the show and have conversations. Daniel, I don't know, frankly. I suspect not, because obviously it is an English-speaking program, and I'm not aware that we have that many downloads of the podcast from Hungary. But if you are listening in Budapest, Hungary, let me know. Email me, unbelievable@premier.org.uk, and I will put you in touch with Daniel, and who knows, perhaps a little international version of the Unbelievable Skeptic and Christian Discussion Group could be begun. Speaking of which, they are having another meeting in their London branch. Live and Let Live, it's called A Christian Response to Pluralism. That's the title of the next discussion they'll be having on Monday, the 13th of November, happening as usual at Somerstown Coffee House between King's Cross and Euston Stations in London. That's 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. Ed and the whole gang will be pleased to see you if you've never been along for the discussions they have. I was at their last one in October and it was a lot of fun. So their speaker this time is Ben Jones, giving a Christian response to pluralism in religion. He's pastor of Friars Baptist Church in Basildon, Essex. Well qualified to speak on pluralism as he's lived and worked for 8 years in Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. And there'll be the usual Q&A and wider discussion time after his talk. So get down there, have a drink and join the conversation on Monday, 13th of November. That's the Unbelievable Christian and Skeptic Discussion Group. More details about that from meetup.com. We're going to be hearing some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme a bit later on, but every so often, frankly, just to make myself feel good as much as anything, I read out some of the responses we got to a competition we ran a few months ago, encouraging people to enter to win signed copies of the Unbelievable book. Well, it produced such a wide range of encouraging comments about the show from all kinds of listeners around the world. I sometimes just read them out to see who's listening where and why they listen. So, for instance, Marty Johnson said, "I've been an avid Unbelievable listener for over 10 years, constantly encouraged and challenged in my faith because of it. I can't count how many times a certain episode will send me back to scripture, to scratch an itch in my brain or heart due to what was said on either side of the table." Nelson says, "God bless you, Justin. I've been listening for a few years now. I live in Brooklyn, New York. As you may be aware, New York is a very skeptical place. I've lived here all my life, and I'm grateful for any ministry that's willing to tackle the tough topics and be open, honest, persuasive, kind, but not compromising. The programme has only strengthened my resolve in the faith of the Christ Jesus that I put my faith in 13 years ago. Thank you. And even if I don't win, I'll continue to promote your programme and pray for you. God bless. Keep up the good fight." Tyler says, "I love Unbelievable. Been listening for a few years on podcasts on the recommendation of a former co-worker. The show's been one of several things that really allowed me to make my faith my own. Before the show, I'd never really given much thought to why I subscribe to the Christian faith. Unbelievable showed me that being a Christian not only makes sense in today's world, but provides the best explanation of why the world is the way that it is." Thank you very much. And Zach says, "I listen to Unbelievable because the topics fascinate me. Apologetics became a huge part of my faith journey in high school after growing up in an American evangelical context that seemed rather hollow. Justin's an extremely gifted curator and moderator. Love the format." And Joyce said, "I'm a longtime Christian who stumbled upon Unbelievable about a year ago when searching online for refutations to Bart Ehrman's bold proclamations of the unreliability of the New Testament. Archived episodes I've listened to have been very beneficial, and I've been hooked on the program ever since. Thank you, Justin, for starting the Unbelievable venture 10 years ago, praying for you and your family." And so it goes on. Thank you for all those who've got in touch on the back of that competition to let me know why they listen. And again, if you want to get hold of the Unbelievable book for yourself, unbelievablebook.co.uk. In fact, you don't have to enter a competition to get a signed copy. They're available now from our website. You can get them at unbelievablebook.co.uk. And now, time to conclude today's discussion.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Such an interesting conversation we've had today between Mike McCarg, a.k.a. Science Mike, author of Finding God in the Waves. He's returned to talk about his perspective on faith and science today on the show, interacting with J.D. Walters, who's a Christian maths and science teacher, fascinated by big questions of God and faith. So interesting to hear both your stories from the outset and also the different ways in which you've kind of put together your faith and your scientific understanding of the world again. J.D. obviously coming out, you know, more in favour, if you like, of a rationalistic understanding of God as being a valid description of reality, a valid thing to base one's belief at some level in God on. Mike, what I found from you is that, you're not going to, if that works for JD, no problem. But from your perspective, a lot of people you meet, they're just not in a place where they're going to recognize that account of reality. And you have to kind of start at a different level to some extent with them. And you had to with yourself as well in your own journey. We're just concluding the program, really. But have you validated the discussion firstly today? Do you often find that, you know, obviously Mike and JD has really had a lot of opportunity to think about these things. He's got quite a, as you say, sophisticated view of mm-hmm. these things. Do you find that there's room for JD's analysis of the way we should bring together God and science and thinking and rationality in things?
Well, of course I'm going to say there's room. Like that,
because you're the peacemaker.
These are the hardest conversations for me to have. I don't worry about JD at all. He obviously knows what he believes and why. But the thing that scares me about these conversations is someone encounters my work for the first time. And my work is really meant for people who want to believe in God and just can't get there via rational means. They've read every book that JD's read, and they still feel like they're on the outside looking in. Those are the people I want to help. And what worries me about conversations like we've had today is people who are where JD is, but with less grounding and sophistication, hearing the conversation, and their takeaway is, oh my gosh, God doesn't exist. What have you done to me, Science Mike? And that's the least thing I desire in the world. I think that if this faith is what we say it is. At its heart is love, peace, gentleness, these fruits of the Spirit. And I just hope that anytime we have conversations that are centered in rational justification or rational inquiry, we all are at a place where we understand even biblically the output of this faith should be this gracious posture towards reality and towards others.
Really fun having you on the show today. Of course, you can get Mike on his own podcast, Ask Science Mike. And there's also, of course, The Liturgist, which I'm a regular listener to as well, where you're on with Michael Gunger and so on. So great to have you on the show. JD, thanks for being on today. And I hope you've enjoyed the conversation as well, have you?
Oh, absolutely. This has been great fun.
Where can people find out more about your stuff, JD? Because obviously findinggodinthewaves.com for Mike. Where could people read more of your own blogs and so on?
Well, I've just started the process of collecting some of my scattered writings. I've kind of written different things in different places in different contexts, but I did recently put together a website called godnaturally.com, and there's a sort of list of most of what I've written on various blogs and in various formats. Some of it is quite embarrassing to look at now, but I think that it's a good record, because like I said, I believe faith is a journey. So I do think there's value in looking back even on things that would make me cringe today. But godnaturally.com is where most of my writing that's on the internet and that doesn't take place on a Facebook forum or something like that can be found.
And just a final question for you, JD, if you were talking to someone who was struggling to believe in God, would you would you give them would you give them, I don't know, something like a typical rationalist book, you know, making the case for faith, or would you give them Science Mike's book? I guess would that depend on the person sitting in front of you?
Yeah, it would definitely depend on the person. The first thing I would do is try to tease out what's actually going on, because for most people, myself included, their first stab at articulating what's going on rarely gets to the heart of the issue. But in terms of if the issue really is someone who's doubting whether to believe in God, I do think I would want to give them not actually a work of apologetics, but probably a work that is fairly accessible, but that was written by one of the great minds either in the Christian tradition or earlier in history. Because I think my fundamental response to Mike's book is that when it comes to the rational case for God, we can do better than simply have to hope for things like, oh, there's a God and he's listening and he answers our prayers. I think it's an historical, to go with the historical analysis, I think it's a historical anomaly of modernity that people have lost faith in the power of reason to illuminate fundamental questions. And we're kind of in this space now that it's really similar to, for example, what Schleiermacher was doing way back when, where basically, okay, we abandon faith as a rational hypothesis. Let's just focus on what the psychological aspects of faith are and how we experience it. But if you move back just a little further, before the birth of the modern period, you find this really rich, exciting discussion where the greatest minds in science and philosophy are basically saying, look, we want to know whether there's a God. We're going to use all our powers of reason. Sure, we may not be able to completely analyze in exact detail what God is and whether God exists, but we can get to a point where belief in God, we can embrace it confidently. Yeah. So I'd like to move people more in that direction, like a sort of to take from Obama here. Yes, we can. we can talk about God rationally, and we can make progress on these fundamental questions.
Great to have you on the show, JD. Thank you. GodNaturally.com for his collected writings. FindingGodInTheWaves.com for Mike McCarg. Mike, I hope you'll come in again next time you're in our direction. Be great to have you.
Anytime.
Great to have you. Thanks for being with me, guys, on the show. Coming up next, some of your feedback to recent editions of the programme.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Do get in touch with what you thought about the conversation today. unbelievable@premier.org.uk. That's the email address. You can also find us on social media at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB to follow the show on Facebook. You can leave your comments there, of course, as well as seeing the things I post up on a regular basis to do with the show and to do with other interesting bits and pieces. Very often posting articles and blogs from the Premier Christianity website. That's the monthly magazine that I actually edit. That's the other major part of my job here at Premier. And as ever, we've got our latest edition, the November edition, really fascinating front cover feature on whether it's time to start praying for revival again, a very popular edition. That's available for free. If you're not a subscriber and you'd like to get hold of a free sample edition of the mag, go to premierchristianity.com/freesample. I'm afraid that's only available to UK dwellers, but we are hoping to make something of a similar nature available digitally to overseas people in the future. So if you've heard me mention the articles and the magazine a number of times in the US, but never been able to ask for a free sample copy, there might be something coming your way in the future. So watch this space. Right, time to see what you've been saying in relation to recent editions of the programme. We're going to save over responses to last week's programme. That was two eminent astrophysicists, one the atheist, Sean Carroll, the other a Christian, Luke Barnes, talking about whether naturalism or theism is the best explanation of the universe. And that's generated certainly a lot of response. But loads of responses that I'll try and get to a number of to the Young Earth versus Evolution episode of the programme a couple of weeks ago. But the programme before last, Andy Hill, the young atheist who decided to try going along to church and got into a conversation with Glenn Scrivener on the show, who's an ordained Anglican minister. That really generated a lot of interesting response as well. Steve Pond got in touch to say the latest show was like listening into a chat concerning various aspects of my spiritual life over the past few years. I found myself starting occasionally to attend the Anglo-Catholic church over the road from my house. I liked the architecture and the sense of history I felt on entering the building. The thought that people who had lived in my house 100 years before had been christened, married and buried there. Even now, at the quite early morning service, I'm sometimes aware that I sit where others of my community did years before. And Deo Volenete in the future after I'm gone, which hopefully won't be for a while. Somebody else will be sitting in that place also. I also found deeply satisfying, and do so more as time moves on, the thought that the symbols and rituals found within the building point to truths beyond ourselves. It might not be a Hillsong or an HTB, but there's one reason I'm there, as it meets me where I am and as who I am. Not that there's anything wrong with churches like that, of course. There are other contributions from events and people that have brought me to this point I could raise, but I'll leave those out for brevity. I can completely understand why then Andy, for those particular reasons above, our own children are long since grown up, is attracted to attend a church of a particular ilk, which scratches that itch. I can't comment on his future with regard to his relationship to the church and God, but merely compare my past with his present. Who knows, though? He might also end up being on the PCC, should reading endless pieces of paper appeal to him. I really enjoyed listening to the discussion because, as I wrote, I could, in particular aspects, identify with topics covered in it. It was, for me, a programme more of the heart than the head and caused me to pause and reflect on the matters mentioned above. Thanks, Steve. Lovely to hear from you. Clinton says, I've been a listener to Unbelievable about a year. I love the show, and even though I consider myself a Christian, often find myself agreeing with the non-Christian guests more. Your show with Andy Hill was my favourite yet. I could hear him smiling through the radio. My story is different from his. I did grow up in a Christian family, fell away from it, and then started going to church for the ritual of it. But his journey reminded me of my own a lot. Listening to what he said, he sounds like a Christian to me, and the kind I wish there were a lot more of. I'm not convinced belief is as important as living out Christ's difficult but beautiful vision of the kingdom. And he sounds like he's finding out what it's like to live that out. Anyway, wonderful show. If I didn't live across the pond, I'd want to be Andy's pal. Thanks, Clinton. Anne says, nice to hear the good-humoured discussion about Andy, who goes to church even though he's not a Christian. I think he should go to an Alpha evening, which explains so well about Christianity. They cover the meaning of life, suffering, healing, heaven, etc. As Nikki Gumbel says, people don't need to commit to attending the whole course. They can just go along to one or two, first of all, see how they get on. They share food, laughter, and put people at their ease. I think Andy would like it. And Stephen Bedard said, I just listened to your show with the atheist who attends church. I ended that show feeling blessed, both that an atheist would be so open-minded and that he found Christians who were welcoming and friendly. Both things renew my hope. That's Stephen, pastor of Queen Street Baptist Church out in Canada. And Kyle says, greetings from upstate New York, Justin. Been a while since I've written, but I remain an avid listener. Show just gets better and better. I'd like to raise an issue, though, with the mad, bad or God argument briefly referenced in the episode featuring Andy and Glenn, specifically the term mad. Considering this argument's alternate phrasing of liar, lunatic or lord, I'll take mad to mean crazy or delusional. The argument suggests that atheists like Andy and myself shouldn't find any value in Jesus's teachings if he claims to be the son of a god we do not believe exists. What the argument suggests about mad people is that they've nothing worth saying, and what it really means by mad people is the mentally ill. As someone who's been in treatment for mental illness for several years and know many good people who share similar struggles, I find this idea frankly hurtful. I'm not trying to call you or Glenn out in particular. This is a common sentiment and one that contributes to the stigma that keeps people from reaching out for help. Mental illness is nothing to be ashamed of. It's as real as physical illness, even if the symptoms aren't externally visible and just as treatable. I'm not trying to make the argument that Jesus was mentally ill. All I want to say is, so what if he was? If Jesus was wrong about being the Son of God, that's a pretty major thing to be wrong about, but it in no way detracts from the beauty of teachings like, there is no greater love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Being wrong about one thing doesn't make one wrong about everything else. Thank you very much, Kyle. I appreciate that perspective too. Okay, let's move on to other emails that have come in, and these are in regards to the episode where John Mackay, a young earth creationist, went head-to-head with Keith Fox, who's a theistic evolutionist. They were talking about Genesis and genetics and all kinds of other things as well in the course of that program. So I would say that responses to this came in at about two-thirds against the young earth creation position and about a third in support of it. So I'm going to try and read emails from both sides of this. Let's start with those who were against the young earth point of view. Kevin in Portland, Oregon says, I was so looking forward to the age of the earth discussion this week. A frustrating mismatch, though. John Mackay's arguments were awful. Jesus turning water into wine is obviously easier to accept than a six-day creation, not because the old earther has too small a view of God. Instead, it's easier to accept because there aren't decades of objective data going against Jesus's wine miracle. In other words, the issue isn't that God couldn't have made the earth in a week. Sure, he could have. The issue is that all the evidence shows he didn't. So when the book of nature contradicts your interpretation of the Old Testament, do you adjust your interpretation of all the observations in nature? Any reasonable theologian and scientist would adjust their subjective interpretation over adjusting objective observations. Thank you very much, Kevin. This one from Vince in Glenside, Pennsylvania says, as a fellow geologist and Christian, I was disappointed by Mr. Mackay's characterization of the geological evidences for the age of the earth, but I think I was most disappointed with his characterization of Charles Lyell. He quoted him as saying that he was looking to free the science, as in geology, from Moses, and took that to mean that Lyell's science was fatally biased by his philosophical predisposition to abandon scripture. However, Lyell was a Christian, and so were many other natural scientists during the 19th century. Moreover, the context of the time needs to be understood. Before Lyell wrote Principles of Geology in 1830, a dominant unifying theory was catastrophism, which understood Earth history as being shaped by catastrophic events like Noah's flood. Well-known geologists, including William Buckland and Adam Sedgwick, believed that massive floods were largely responsible for the geological record. Lyell, who studied under Buckland, also held this view at one time. However, geologists began to abandon catastrophism as the geologic record grew more complicated, such that it would not be explained solely by flood events. The rock record in any given area may have given you evidence for a variety of ancient terrestrial climates, and sweeps of strata would reveal snapshots of whole ecosystems. These were evidences that were not consistent with chaotic flood deposits. A quote from William Buckland, who was a Christian and originally championed deluge theory, helps to shed light on Lyell's statement and the thinking of geologists during this time. Several hypotheses have been proposed with a view of reconciling the phenomena of geology with the brief account of creation which we find in the Mosaic narrative. Some have attempted to ascribe the formation attention of all the stratified rocks to the effects of the Mosaic Deluge, an opinion which is irreconcilable with the enormous thickness and almost infinite subdivisions of these strata. As Dr. Fox stated, Lyell was only trying to maintain an appropriate use of scripture by separating it from interpretations in geology. Thank you very much, Vince. Again, from Stephen in Queen Street Baptist Church in Canada, I thought the debate between Mackay and Fox illustrated an important truth when it comes to apologetic conversations. Even if I thought Mackay had the better evidence, which I don't, his tone came across as disrespectful, while Fox's comments were calm, ironic, and ultimately more convincing. How we say what we say is just as important. Maybe time for one more critical one before we hear a few positive ones on John Mackay's side. This from W. Yang on Facebook said, I've been a long time listener, love the programme, and I truly appreciate John's approach, though I find it inconsistent and inconvenient at times from his perspective. If we take Genesis 1 literally, we'd also have to affirm the firmament in the sky. Moon explorations would have ended disastrously if that were indeed the case. That's how Moses and the audience of his time understood the cosmos. I'm not against God accommodating for people in a given time and place. I don't believe it's a stretch to estimate that Jesus was making theological points and not necessarily historical or scientific points when referring to man and woman. Joshua's account of the earth standing still can also be seen as a theological point. We don't adopt a geocentric model today. John's literal style is a methodological approach he adopts, but it doesn't mean it's absolute. John is also using science, but filtering the data to fit his framework. Thank you very much. So here's some that were in favour, though, of John Mackay's approach. Tim in Saskatoon, Canada said, thanks so much for having John Mackay on the show. John came to my church in a desolately cold Canadian town and was the first person who was able to give me the ability to show the Bible is not against science and honestly had a large influence on my apologetic learning. I love the fact that there are men and women out there who are willing to stand on the Bible with eyes open. It's very reassuring to see someone who's able to answer the scientific accusations against the Bible by pointing to the root assumptions that the vast majority of accepted science has made. Ultimately, for the Christian, the argument always comes down to whether we can trust the Bible or not. If we find ourselves trying to mould the Bible into saying something other than what is apparent, we completely lose all confidence in the Bible's sufficiency. This one came in on Facebook from Matt in Michigan, says, love the show. Lively discussions certainly make my long drive, commute drive, a lot less unbearable. I wanted to write a note about the show between Mackay and Fox. As someone who works with computer systems and programming language on a daily basis in my career, I was thrilled when I heard Mackay state that one of the reasons why genetic code is so similar is because there was one designer who reused that same code within multiple creations. In computer programming, which is essentially the communication of information from one place to another, the reuse of similar bits of code which are known to execute successfully within a given development space is a common practice. In my mind, it makes logical sense that God would use similar bits of genetic code throughout his creation because those bits work in the space he developed them in. I was yelling out, yes, yes, thank you, in my car after John said that. Shouldn't it seem obvious that if a single all-powerful designer set about making a world full of creatures, that his code would have a similar footprint all throughout? Being similar does not necessarily infer that we all came from the same species, but rather that we come from the same designer. Thank you for all you do, Justin. Keep it up. Thank you, Matt in Michigan. Maybe time for one more. Michael in Cameroon, who says, thanks for the discussion aired on creationism and evolution involving John Mackay and Fox. It was entertaining and informative, with even a bit of vim in the give and take between the two. But can you pass on to the Joker, who said creationists shouldn't even be allowed on your program, that if he doesn't want to hear alternatives to evolution theory, then he should just stick with the BBC. This is a Christian radio station, and all significant Christian points of view deserve an airing. Thank you very much for all who have been in touch about recent editions of the show. As I say, saving up some of those responses to that very popular, again, edition of the show on cosmology from last week, Sean Carroll and Luke Barnes, for another show in the future. But do come again, same time next week, if you can, for more interesting dialogue and debate. And I've got something really different for you next week. You're unbelievable. Next week we're asking, is miracle healing for real? Ken Fish heads up a healing ministry that takes him around the world. Well, he's going to be in conversation with Skeptical Show listener Francis Janusz, and we'll be hearing from people who claim to have been healed by Ken Fish's ministry. Yes, we're doing healing, ministry, miracles, all of that kind of thing on next week's show. Hope you can come back for it. Should be a really cracking edition of the programme. You've been listening to the Unbelievable podcast. Subscribe on iTunes, Podbean, or any other podcasting software, and find out more about our other Premier podcasts at premier.org.uk/podcasts.